Nana, har du nogensinde oplevet noget overnaturligt?
Det ved jeg. Nej, måske. Altså, jeg har engang spillet ånden i glasset, og så var der en engel, der lå ude i køkkenet. Der var lavet sådan noget porcelæn, der faldt ned på gulvet og gik i stykker.
Okay. Hvor gammel var du?
Det, omkring,
det var i går.
Sådan, ja, det var i går. Nej, omkring 10-11 år eller sådan noget.
Ja,
det var,
ja.
Vi gjorde det relativt ofte.
Ja.
Og så var vi alle sammen meget forskrækket.
Mine damer og herrer, her er endnu en kendsgerning om hjernen.
Du lytter til en videnskab.dk-podcast, støttet af Lundbeckfonden.
Som I kan høre, stiller vi den nu over til åndernes verden. I denne episode skal vi nemlig dykke ned i psykologien bag troen på det paranormale og overnaturlige.
Det bliver uhyggeligt. Hvorfor tror nogle mennesker på ting som spøgelser, flyvende tallerkener, drømmetydning og tidligere liv? Det er blandt andet noget af det, vi skal dykke ned i. Og det skal den britiske forsker Chris French faktisk gøre os meget klogere på i dag. Han forsker nemlig lige præcis i psykologien bag det paranormale, og han har faktisk været et smut forbi podcaststudiet for at dele ud til mig af sin viden.
Ja, vi har jo snydt lidt, for det var faktisk dig, Anne-Sophie, der havde ham i studiet forleden. Så skal vi ikke bare høre dit interview med ham?
Jo, men lad os lige præsentere os først. Jeg hedder Anne-Sophie Tingsted.
Jeg hedder Nana Elving Hansen. Velkommen til Brainstorm.
Okay, lyttere, I hørte mig lige alle sammen med Nana i podcaststudiet. Men mens det her er optaget, sidder jeg faktisk over for Chris French, der er professor emeritus i psykologi på University of London. Han er aktuel med bogen The Science of Weird Shit, Why Our Minds Conjure the Paranormal, som udkommer i marts. Nå, men for at Chris skal forstå mig, slår jeg lige over i engelsk. Chris, you are here in Copenhagen because you're giving a talk at the event Science and Cocktails, and you're here in Brainstorm with me today to dive into the, if I have to say so myself, fascinating question of why our minds conjure up the paranormal, which is your field of study, and what an interesting one at that. Welcome to Brainstorm.
Glad to be here.
And Chris, I'm also very curious about a thing, because I was wondering how a researcher gets interested in the paranormal, because if you ask me, it's a subject that is almost couldn't be farther away from science. So are you superstitious yourself, or how did it come about?
I used to actually believe in a lot of this stuff up until kind of well into early adulthood, doing an undergraduate degree in psychology in Manchester. This kind of topic was hardly even mentioned on my psychology degree course. And it wasn't until I was doing my PhD in a completely different area and a friend just recommended a particular book that he thought I would enjoy. Yeah. It was called Parapsychology, Science or Magic. And it was by a Canadian social psychologist called James Alcock. And I did indeed enjoy the book. And it was the first skeptical treatment of all this stuff that I'd ever come across. And I found the arguments very convincing. And that's the moment that I became a skeptic. So reading that one book had a huge impact on my future career.
But are you still superstitious after these many years of researching?
Yes and no, I think, would be the honest answer to that. I think coming from a place where I used to believe in this stuff, I can kind of understand when people behave superstitiously and maybe even sometimes kind of feel a vague temptation in that direction myself. But on the other hand, the rational part of me thinks, no, don't be silly. that's silly. And so generally, no, I'm not superstitious. I think most people would say I'd be very low in terms of any kind of measures of superstitiousness.
Right.
But I can still kind of, I can still feel that it's there. So I think that kind of irrational side of being human is part of all of us. We may try and deny it. We may think of ourselves as being super duper rational, but we can show in well-controlled studies that people, even those who think of themselves as being very, very rational, often behave irrationally.
Right, and that's very fascinating, and we will definitely get into that, because I feel very much like you say that I'm not superstitious either, but I do have these irrational beliefs that sometimes surface. But I guess, after all, I am a science journalist, so it would probably surprise the listeners if I were to say now that I'm extremely superstitious. But actually, when I did the research for this episode, I was surprised about how many people actually do believe in the paranormal. I found a report from 2018 in which researchers from Aarhus University asked over 2,000 Danes if they believed in anything supernatural. And actually, around 1 in 3 said that they believed in dream interpretation, and also that we have a spirit apart from our physical body. And I have a question about that to you, Chris, because according to that report, the Danes tend to believe in much more diffuse paranormal phenomena rather than the very sort of concrete, like vampires and werewolves. Do you have any idea why that might be?
It's an interesting kind of observation. And I suspect that if you were to dig a little bit deeper, you'd probably find variations within the Danish population. I mean, typically, you'll tend to find that what we might think of as kind of traditional superstitions, like not walking under ladders and breaking mirrors, bringing bad luck and so on, that tends to be more strongly believed amongst the less educated population, whereas the more educated population may not believe so much in that stuff, but they believe in an awful lot of other stuff, which I would class as superstitious, such as feng shui and various new age type ideas. They're much more likely to be found amongst the wealthy, well-educated classes. And I suspect that would be the case within Denmark too. I mean, I can, again, in terms of the psychology of each and every one of these beliefs, there's often going to be kind of subtle differences in terms of the kind of factors that are behind it. So when it comes to something like belief in a spirit or an immortal soul, then I can see there's all kinds of factors that play into that. But one of the most obvious is just the fact that, you know, we don't like the idea of mortality. None of us do. Not only do we not like the idea that when we die, that's the end of us, but the idea that when our loved ones die, we'll never have any further contact with them at all is not something that most of us feel very happy about.
Nå, Anne-Sophie, så er vi lige tilbage i podcaststudiet, hvor vi har lyttet til den første del af dit interview med Chris French.
Ja, og vi snakkede jo også om den her danske rapport fra Aarhus Universitet, som har undersøgt danskernes overtro. Så en ting, jeg egentlig lige ville nævne omkring den her rapport, er, at forskerne har indhentet svar fra danskerne ved at sende spørgeskemaer ud på X, altså det tidligere Twitter og så Facebook. Så selvom der var mange mennesker med i undersøgelsen, er de måske ikke repræsentative for hele Danmarks befolkning.
Men selvom rapporten ikke giver et knivskarpt billede af danskernes overtro, så peger den alligevel overordnet set på to ting. At vi danskere generelt set tror på videnskaben snarere end ånder og aliens, men at der alligevel er relativt mange danskere, der faktisk er overtroiske.
Ja, og jeg var altså også overrasket over, at 1 ud af 7 lader til at tro på spøgelser, fordi altså, vi ved jo godt, at danskerne tror på videnskaben, eller en relativt stor del af os gør i hvert fald, ikke?
Ja, det er faktisk, det synes jeg er overraskende.
Det er ret mange. Men altså, det betyder jo bare, at der er masser af grund til at stille skarpt på de psykologiske årsager til, at vi rent faktisk tror på de her ting, så relativt mange af os. Og det er også det, det skal handle om nu, fordi nu stiller vi nemlig tilbage til anden del af mit interview med Chris French. So Chris, now let's dive into the paranormal mind, because I know you spent quite a bit of time doing exactly that at London University, and there you are head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit. Now to get into that, what is anomalistic psychology, first of all?
Well, that phrase, I didn't actually come up with it, but what used to happen to me on quite a regular basis would people would say, what's your area of research? And I would have to say, oh, it's the psychology of anomalous and paranormal experiences and related beliefs, which is a bit of a mouthful. So I wanted something more concise.
Yeah.
And so I looked around and this term anomalistic psychology was already in existence. And so I could say to people when they said, what's your area of research? I could say anomalistic psychology. And of course, nobody had ever heard of anomalistic psychology. So then they'd say, what's that? And I'd have to say, it's the psychology of paranormal and anomalous experience. So it didn't really do the job, but I'm trying to popularize the term. It's basically anomalistic psychology is primarily focused upon trying to come up with non-paranormal explanations for ostensibly paranormal experiences. And wherever possible, put those to the test, see if we can actually produce some evidence to support our non-paranormal explanations. So it adopts that as a kind of working hypothesis. So we're saying, let's just assume that paranormal forces don't exist. Can we explain a whole range of weird experiences that people report, from alien abduction claims to having psychic powers, to encounters with ghosts, the whole lot. Can we explain those things in psychological rather than parapsychological terms? So although it's obviously a generally sceptical approach, we don't kind of take a hard line of saying we know that paranormal forces don't exist. We just say, well, we're going to start off from the assumption they don't and see how far we can get in explaining those experiences.
Okay, so it's sort of twofold. First of all, you're trying to give non-paranormal explanations to why people believe in the paranormal. And second of all, you're also actually staying open in the sense that you are testing whether those paranormal phenomena could be true.
Absolutely.
And one of the ways you do that is to go into cognitive biases. And Chris, one of the cognitive biases that seem to be at play in people's belief in the paranormal is something called pareidolia. And I know there is a particular song played backwards that you like to use to explain this phenomena. So should we hear it?
I think we should.
All righty, let's find it. All right, so I'm pretty sure the listeners have absolutely no idea what they just heard. So Chris, could you tell them what this song I just played backwards is and what it has to do with the term pareidolia that I mentioned before?
That's actually a slightly edited clip.
It is, it is.
Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin, one of my favourite tracks, played forwards. Actually, I really like it played backwards these days. And the point about this is that when it comes to pareidolia, it's the tendency that we have to sometimes see or hear clear stimuli in what's essentially random noise, okay? Because it's one of those things that one of our greatest strengths as a species is that we're really good at picking up on patterns and meaning and significance in terms of what's going on around us.
Right.
And that generally is a very positive thing, but sometimes we overplay it. We think we see something meaningful or hear something meaningful in what is actually just random noise. And this is my favourite ever example. It happens to be in the auditory domain. A lot of examples of pareidolia are in the visual domain, particularly the tendency to see faces in things like clouds or a stain on the floor and so on. But in the auditory domain, the claim was put about, particularly by American Christian fundamentalists, that rock music contains satanic messages. And these are hidden so that you can't hear them when you play the record forwards, but if you play it backwards and listen really hard, you can hear these hidden messages. And there are lots of websites you can go to and play these messages. And I strongly recommend that people do because it's great fun. What you typically find is you can't understand what the message is supposed to be until someone tells you or you read it. And then you play it again and you think, oh, yeah, I can hear it now.
Right.
And the meaning that you hear when you've been told what the message is and you hear it again is all in your head. It's not really there.
Right. And so what you're saying is that pareidolia, it covers our tendency to see or hear a pattern or a meaning where there is in fact none. It could be a visual pattern, for example, seeing a face in a
piece of toast or in a cloud or in a tree or something like that. But it could also, as it is in this case, be hearing certain words spoken backwards in a song where there are no words. So let's test that concept and hear the song played backwards again. But first, I'm going to actually read the satanic lyrics to the listeners. So what it is, what the satanic message is supposed to be is, here is to my sweet Satan, he will give you 666. Let's see if you can hear it this time. Right. And I think, at least for me, I could definitely hear it much more this time.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as I say, it's a nice kind of classroom demonstration. I just like to look at the, just watch the faces of the students, or if it's a public lecture, the face of the audience, because you literally get people kind of open mouth going, oh, what? And sometimes you have to convince them that the clip you play the second time is indeed the same clip as you played them the first time, because they just don't believe it. It does have, you know, just sounds so differently the same
time. It really does. But what does it have to do with superstition in the traditional sense? Because one thing is hearing the words in a backwards song that is in fact complete gibberish, and another thing is believing it, you know?
Well, that's right. Again, I think that's an important point to make, because, I mean, again, if you go back to the visual domain, and particularly this tendency to see faces, then for most of us, it's just a kind of, you know, you'll kind of turn to your friend and say, oh, look, you can see a face, and that's it. You just smile and laugh it off. However, if that face happens to look like the face of Jesus Christ, and it's on the wall in a church, then you'll get pilgrims coming from thousands of miles around to come and pay homage, you know. So it all, again, context is always really important in these situations.
It seems like, yeah, so it is a little nudge that you're getting from someone, and then your brain is just very ready to accept that nudge.
Exactly.
But Chris, now that we have learned about the cognitive bias pareidolia, we are going to move on to another cognitive bias that also seems to influence people's belief in the paranormal, the so-called Barnum effect. Now, I know that the Barnum effect is at play when mentalists or mediums do so-called cold readings. Now, this is a technique to obtain information about a person by using high probability guessing. And I actually have a personal interest in the answer to this next question. So, Chris, could you explain what the Barnum effect is and how it applies to the belief in cold readings?
As I said, there's lots of different aspects to cold reading. It's not just the Barnum effect, but the Barnum effect provides a very good base for padding out a reading. Basically, there are certain kinds of statements that sound as if they're saying something very perceptive about your innermost personality, but in actual fact, apply to everybody. So there's a classic kind of Barnum reading that's been used since 1949 in research and still works as well to this day. And it's essentially, I can't remember it word for word, but it includes phrases like, you have a great deal of unused potential. You know, so you've achieved quite a lot in life, but there's so much more you could achieve if you could just tap into that potential. And we all think, yes, that's me. You know, you've got a better than average sense.
I mean,
of humor.
I believed it a little bit when you looked at
of
me
course,
and said it just
yeah,
now.
You say it with sincerity.
I'm like, yeah,
and you're not thinking in terms of, does this apply to everybody? You're thinking, yes, that's me. You know, you've got a better than average sense of humor as well. You know, obviously, if other people don't laugh at things that you find funny, well, they're the ones with the dodgy sense of humour. Your sense of humour is the right one. You know? You can pad out a reading for a long time with just those kind of statements. But people will often come away from a reading with a fake psychic or a fake medium convinced that they were told really specific details, and that the Barnum technique can't do. I say the Barnum effect is an effect. It applies not only in this kind of context. It applies to all kinds of psychological tests that claim that they can measure your personality.
So basically the Barnum effect is sort of like, again, this little notch to our mind that we want to believe in vague generalistic statements about ourselves. Our brain wants to find meaning, and it wants these statements to apply to ourselves. And the reason I do have a little bit of a personal interest in this topic is that I actually somehow ended up getting a reading by a spiritual medium when I was 12 years old, so it's been a while. And he told me that one day I was going to become very interested in a country on the other side of the globe. And the thing is that I am actually very passionate about Japan and have traveled and lived there several times. So it's the kind of thing that annoys me because even though I don't believe in these things, I have to admit that whenever I think about that reading, I can't help but wonder, like, how could this medium have known that I was going to be so interested in Japan?
It's quite interesting the way you said that, because it sounded as if the medium didn't actually say you are going to become very interested in Japan. The medium said on the other side of the world.
Right.
Now that covers an awful lot of possible possibilities. And also being interested in, I mean, as it happens, you have personally got a passion for Japan and you've been there and you've lived there and so on. But even if you hadn't, maybe if you just had a vague kind of interest in the country, it would still count as a hit.
Okay, so basically, if I have to give a message to the listeners out there, it's don't be like me. Don't be impressed by ambiguous descriptions about yourself coming from spiritual healers or horoscopes, because it might be the Barnum effect that is trying to ensnare you. And with those words of advice, I'm going to go into the last cognitive bias we will talk about today, which is our difficulty to understand statistical probability. So, Chris, could you explain how that applies to our belief in the paranormal?
The thing is that for many, not all, but for many claims of some kind of paranormal experience, the most obvious counter-explanation from skeptics like myself would be, well, maybe it was just a coincidence. So you have a dream about something and then a couple of days later something happens in real life that seems to bear an uncanny correspondence to the dream. Was the dream some kind of psychic glimpse into the future, or was the apparent match just a coincidence? So, you know, a number of people claim that they dreamed about the Twin Towers being hit in a terrorist attack. And there are other kind of examples like that. But there are all kinds of other factors that might come into play with precognitive dreaming. Are people remembering the dream as being more similar to the event than it actually was? Have they sometimes confused the timing? You know, they actually had the dream after the event. So, well, we won't get into all that. I mean, you think about the telephone telepathy example, as it's sometimes called. The number of times in a day that you think of a person's name and either the phone doesn't ring or the phone rings and it's someone else, well, that's a non-event. You don't remember that. But if the phone rings just at the moment you were thinking about that person and you weren't necessarily expecting a call from them at that time, ooh, well, that's a bit spooky, isn't it?
It is a bit spooky, but, indeed.
It's bound to happen. Again, it's just the law of very large numbers.
Which we are just simply not, at least very few of us are capable to really, truly comprehend.
Absolutely.
That. So because we are so bad in general at understanding basic statistics, we are tricked to believe that events that are actually statistically very likely to happen are happening because of some supernatural powers at play. So now, dear listeners, you know three ways our mind can trick you to be superstitious. But if you're a little bit like me and you don't believe in the supernatural, but you cannot help but think, what if it's true? What are then actually some things you can do to prevent your mind from falling into those cognitive traps? That's what we will talk about next. All right, Chris, now we know that the Danes are more superstitious than I originally would have guessed, and we have been through some of the cognitive biases that may explain why. But a question that remains for me is, how strong actually is the evidence that cognitive biases explain paranormal belief?
Again, it will depend upon the particular cognitive bias that you're talking about. There's very good evidence to support the role of cognitive biases with respect to some kinds of experience and belief, and there's mixed evidence with respect to others. So just to give you one example of where there's mixed evidence, we've talked about the problems people have with probability estimation. And there have been lots of studies that have looked to see, well, okay, we're all poor at that, but are believers in the paranormal, do they tend to be a bit worse than the rest of us?
Right.
And the evidence tends to be mixed insofar as some studies don't find any significant differences between groups of believers versus non-believers. But when a difference is found, it is in the direction that we skeptics would expect.
Right, but it does sound like in general the psychology of paranormal belief is hard to measure in a lab, but researchers like you do have good indications that cognitive biases might be at play, and they might play a substantial role as to why we tend to believe in these things. So, Chris, knowing that, what advice would you give to people who believe that Stairway to Heaven is an ode to Satan, or that surely it must be telepathy when they dreamed about their old friend Bob yesterday and he calls them the day after?
I think we can all we can do is aim, basically, it's a matter of trying to get people to use critical thinking skills. So trying to train them in critical thinking skills and how to apply them, and to realize that we all have these biases, including the skeptics. You know, I mean, and I think for me, a really important part of skepticism is to always be open to the possibility that you might be wrong.
Chris French, your advice has now been passed on to the listeners, so they will never make satanic interpretations of songs or try to read their fate in tea leaves. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Så stiller vi tilbage til podcaststudiet igen, hvor jeg, Nana, og du, Anne-Sophie, lige har siddet og hørt dit interview med Chris French.
Og Nana, nu var du jo ikke med, da jeg interviewede Chris, så hvad synes du egentlig om det her med, at der kan være flere forskellige kognitive faldgrupper inde i din hjerne, der ligesom får dig til at tro på de her overnaturlige ting? Er det noget, du selv har erfaring med?
Jamen, altså, jeg kommer til at tænke på... Jeg kommer til at tænke på, at en gang jeg var barn, og så var vi over på min skole om aftenen. Og så troede vi, at vi så nogle røde øjne. Det var sådan, vi var jo måske på første anden sal, og det var lidt nede i kælderen. Og vi tænkte, åh, det er et spøgelse.
Ja.
Men så viste det sig, at jeg ved ikke, vi fik på en eller anden måde mod, du ved, opbygget mod til at gå ned og kigge. Og så var det bare to røde lamper på et eller andet. Jeg ved det ikke, en eltavle eller sådan noget.
Nej, men det giver jo meget god mening i forhold til det, Chris siger med, at man har tendenser til at se ansigter rundt omkring, ikke? At vores hjerne ligesom er primet til at se mønstre og se ansigter i alle mulige mærkelige ting, i en sky eller i et toastbrød eller i mørket, ja, hvad det præcis nu kan være, ikke? Ja. Så har I set sådan et par onde øjne der, men det lyder da også totalt creepy. Jeg ville have været mega bange, hvis det var mig dengang.
Ja, vi var virkelig også bange, men, og vi følte os måske lidt, at vi var med i sådan en horror movie på den fede måde.
Ja, ja. I var lidt seje, at I faktisk gik hele vejen ned og tjekkede efter.
Ja, og så kunne vi jo sagtens se, hvad det var. Men vores hjerner har jo så bare udfyldt et tomrum på en eller anden måde.
Ja, det har den. Ja. Nå, men spørgsmålet er, om vi skal til at runde af for denne uhyggelige episode af Brainstorm.
Det skal vi da. I er altid velkommen til at gå ind på vores Instagram. Der hedder vi brainstorm.podcast. I kan gå ind og få hjernetips. I kan også stille spørgsmål, og I kan også dele nogle uhyggelige, overnaturlige oplevelser med os, hvis vi har lyst.
Det må I meget gerne. Vi læser det hele. Så skal vi nævne, at Brainstorm er støttet af Lundbeck-fonden. Jeg hedder Anne-Sophie Tingsted.
Og jeg hedder Nanne Elving Hansen. Tak fordi du lyttede med.